Only the victim is alive and the murderers are not. It's a pity you didn't know when you started your game of murder that I was playing too.
It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe the ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
Hello, hello, my pretties. It's your host, Ashley Lana, your non-destructive cult leader and certified nightmare prescriber. I'm back, and so are you, fair cult. If this is your first time listening to the show, huge thank you for me personally, because here we like to examine the progression of historical events and crimes. So with that being said, say it with me, fair cult. Welcome to Lullaby. In the previous episode, we investigated the bizarre Canadian case of 12-year-old Jasmine Richardson and her 23-year-old boyfriend, Jeremy Steinke, who believed he was a 300-year-old werewolf, and together they murdered her family in cold blood. This week, well, fear cult, you have been asking me to do Jodi Arias for a long time, and I'm going to be completely honest here. The reason I put her off is because I do not like her. She is creepy, she is obsessive, and I followed her case when she was on trial years ago, and it stuck with me because stalker cases hit home, making them very uncomfortable for me. And in Jodi's story, she tried to manipulate the entire crime to her favor and gain fame through the process. So going through these case documents, it's easy to see how Jodi believes she's so untouchable and that her stalking behavior is appropriate and is allowed to happen. Yeah, fuck it. I'm not going to be nice anymore. I fucking hate her, man. So I'm just going to lay this case right out there for everyone, and you can conclude your own position. We all know where I stand. I try not to come off rude. I try to be very impartial. Again, these are criminals we are discussing. I'm not at any point trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. And this is a WoW episode, which is Fear Cult code for worst of the worst. A list of some of the sources that I read for this episode include the State of Arizona versus Jodi Arias trial, Conviction, the untold story of putting Jodi Arias behind bars by Juan Martinez, the prosecutor during the Jodi Arias case, Trapped with Miss Arias, written by Jodi's defense attorney, Kirk Nurmi, and we'll talk about him near the end of the episode. He likes to not think about his client, Jodi Arias, because she's a goddamn nightmare. And The Wrath of Jodi Arias, Psychology. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains graphic descriptions of stalking, harassment, religion, sex, and murder. Please take into consideration that not all topics are suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Up next, a story that is sweeping across the nation. The murder of Travis Alexander and the woman who was at the center of it all. We sit down with Jodi Arias as she explains her side of the story.
Did you kill Travis Alexander?
I absolutely did not kill Travis. I had nothing to do with his murder. I did not harm him in any way. I witnessed Travis being attacked by two individuals who, I don't know who they were. I couldn't pick them in the police lineup.
So, what happened when they came into Travis's home?
They attacked us both. They were wearing black ski masks, so I couldn't see their faces.
And what happened to you?
They told me to run. And that if I told the police, they would come for me and my family.
Did you call the police?
I was too terrified to call the police. I'm not proud that I just left my friend there to be slaughtered at the hands of two other people. I'm not proud of that at all.
You understand you look guilty here.
I understand that everything. All the evidence against me right now is very compelling.
What we really want to know is what happened there.
In a nutshell, two people, two monsters killed Travis.
You did not shoot Travis?
No, I've never even shot a real gun.
You did not stab him 27 times?
No, I'd never. That's heinous.
You never slit his throat from ear to ear?
I can't imagine slitting anyone's throat. No jury is going to convict me.
Why not?
Because I'm innocent, and you can mark my words on that. That no jury will convict me.
This is the obsessive story of Jodi Arias, The Dirty Little Secret. Jodi Ann Arias was born on July 9, 1980, in Salinas, California, United States. She was the first of five children to William Angelo and Sandra Arias. According to Jodi, her childhood was healthy until she turned 7 years old, claiming her parents would frequently abuse her, specifically saying that her mother would use wooden spoons and leather belts to hurt her. William and Sandra Arias denied the abuse. In a police interview, her mother Sandra said, quote, "Jodi has mental problems. Jodi would often freak out all the time, and I had a few of her friends call and tell me that I needed to get her some help." During interrogations, her father William insisted that Jodi had undiagnosed bipolar disorder, which caused her heavy instability. Jodi would threaten suicide whenever she did not get her way at home. At 14 years old, Jodi was caught growing marijuana in Tupperware containers on the roof of the family home. Her parents called the police and thoroughly searched her bedroom. This was the first time that her parents had ever done this. Jodi felt personally violated and screamed that she would never trust her family again. Her father detailed that this was the pivotal moment where Jodi truly changed. She started lying to avoid all conflict at every opportunity. Psychologist Michelle Ward explained that Jodi's deceitful behavior from a young age reflects how she was more concerned about her own image rather than her family, a primary trait of narcissistic personality disorder. When Jodi's father rationalized his daughter's distrust concerning the marijuana incident, it revealed to Dr. Michelle Ward that William Arias was only trying to parent his daughter, but she didn't see it that way. It was Jodi who manipulated the incident as a power tactic to control her family from then on out. When Jodi played the victim, her parents seemed to back down, gaining her favor. One thing that I instantly recognized about Jodi's personality while I was researching this case is her ability to manipulate and discredit her own actions to portray herself as this perpetual victim. When Jodi is 17, she sees this flyer for school for a 3-week exchange program to Costa Rica, and without even considering her parents' financial status, she just strolls into the kitchen and says, "I'm going to Costa Rica and you can't stop me. Hasta luego, padres." Because her parents, they didn't want her to hate them because they loved her, but she's seen that love as a way to manipulate them and control them. So they helped pay for her to go because she couldn't afford all of it. She was working at the time, but she couldn't afford all the money to go. And they knew if they said no, that she would have a tantrum, and she said that she was gonna hurt herself. So later, Jodi would tell the courts that she was physically abused by her parents, and she claimed that her father pushed her into walls and even a doorframe, rendering her unconscious. Her mother apparently hit her repeatedly, scratching her with her acrylic nails, and her parents denied this. Her siblings never testified to this abuse, so psychiatrists and attorneys, they noticed these little cracks in her stories very quickly. Because Jodi on the stand testified that even though she endured years of physical and mental abuse, she had no hard feelings towards her parents. Experts see this and recognize that her claims don't match her reactions, and this is considered a common crack in Jodi's facade. If you want hours of entertainment, just go watch videos of psychiatrists and psychologists discussing Jodi Arias. She's described as the sanest crazy person you'll ever meet. And the worst part is that you can see this freight train of crazy just barreling at you going 200 miles an hour. Jodi became interested in artistic expression in her teens. She became a talented artist and photographer. And in middle school, she focused primarily on learning Spanish and building her vocabulary. With her parents working full-time, it left Jodi babysitting her two brothers and sister. The family was no longer having meals together, leaving Jodi resentful for having to carry the family's responsibilities. The Arias family moved to Eureka, California when Jodi was 15 years old, after her father had fallen ill. The new school was small and Jodi struggled to integrate into the new environment. She began working as a waitress at a restaurant owned by her parents. It was around this time when 15-year-old Jodi had met an 18-year-old boy named Bobby Juarez. In 1995, Jodi was told by her art teacher, Mr. Rangel, that she had talent. The attention and support was something Jodi lacked, therefore she craved. Her parents were always working to support the family, and she lacked the encouragement. At home, Jody was very unhappy with her parents. They could not discipline her without having to start a fight. Jody stopped caring about her education and started skipping class. Then, at 17 years old, she decided that it was time to drop out, and she secretly moved in with Bobby Juarez. He was now 20 years old with no job and lived in a small trailer with his grandparents. Jody was working full-time as a waitress, paying for the couple's necessities, which soon irritated her to no end. One day, Jody discovered that Bobby was using her money to call 1-800 numbers for phone sex. When Jody found out, she managed to log into his email account at the library to find that he had been having a secret relationship with another girl. When Jody confronted Bobby, the two argued and she ended up moving out and in with her own grandparents. When Jody discussed her relationship with Bobby in an interview, Jody explained, saying, quote, "He was getting very serious and so I felt it was a little bit heavy. He was saying, I love you, and he wanted to spend forever with me, and that sort of thing. It just seemed a bit intense and serious, so I broke it off with him." Jody said in court that she forgave Bobby for betraying her, but she felt victimized, claiming that she stayed with him because she is a good person, but their relationship got too passionate too quickly. In late 1999, 19-year-old Jody saved up enough money from her waitressing job at Denny's to go on a much-needed personal vacation. The destination, Costa Rica. She wanted to go back to get away from Bobby. On her previous trip to Costa Rica on an exchange program for school in 1997, Jody had stayed with a family who had a son her age named Victor. In that time, the two had a sexual fling. After the exchange trip, she and Victor kept in close touch. Victor wanted a long-distance relationship, but according to Jody, he was too possessive. Despite her history with Victor, Jody decided to travel back to Costa Rica to live with his family. Not Victor. Victor had moved out by this time. When Jody moved back home, she moved in with a friend. She continued to hook up with her ex, Bobby, and Jody told the courts that one night the two were hooking up when they got into a heated argument. Bobby allegedly started choking her until she almost fell unconscious. Jody stated that she called her brother, who arrived with his friends at Bobby's house. Bobby then took a decorative sword and began attacking the group. In court, no one confirmed Jody's story. A panel of forensic psychologists and psychiatrists on Dr. Drew noted that this was a similar story to the alleged abuse that she attained from her father. The sudden escalation of violence from non-violent boyfriends will now start to stand out in her testimonies. Jody longed for a healthy relationship, but her lack of self-confidence and insecurities manifested itself into an unhealthy obsession with men. Jody would give 100% of herself in every relationship, to the point of jealousy when it was not reciprocated with the same intense energy back. Jody would then begin to internalize all her repressed rage. Later in 1999, Jody had moved to Santa Monica, California to live with another friend. She started working at Applebee's and keeping in contact with Bobby, who would come and visit her regularly. Jody was struggling financially and ended up moving back to Eureka with her grandparents. Bobby had moved away to Medford, Oregon at this time, and the two would continue to keep in contact. When Jody would visit Bobby, she managed to mingle into his friend group. He lived with a roommate named Matt McCarthy, and Jody became very close with him. When Jody asked Matt if she could move in with his parents, he said yes. Jody was questioned why she would want to move in with her ex-boyfriend's roommate's parents. She said, quote, "Well, there was no rent. They took me in to get me on my feet so I could get a job and be in an area where there was lots available." Jody began dating Bobby's roommate, Matt, and Bobby then moved out, and Jody moved in. The couple had only known each other for 3.5 months. Jody explained that Matt had everything she needed: stability, romance, and spirituality. The two joined a martial arts class together, and she started taking Matt's meditation seminars. Jody started exploring Hinduism because Matt was practicing. She believed molding herself into what she believed he wanted as an ideal partner. Meanwhile, Matt had started an affair with another woman in Crater Lake, Oregon. When Jody found out, she ramped up their sex life and hoped to keep Matt's attention on her. Jody drove the 70 miles to Crater Lake to confront the mysterious woman. Jody told the court that multiple random people would approach her on the street to tell her that Matt was cheating on her. Attorneys questioned why random people would even care. Jody only shrugged. These patterns that she will carry forward are very dangerous, and it's important to remember that all these testimonies are from Jody's point of view. All of her stories have the same sequence of events. She said her father choked her, Bobby choked her, and she will later say that Travis choked her. So Jody would continue to sleep with all her exes trying to win them back until she would find a new man to distract her. Jody knew that she was beautiful. Jody knew that she had the sexual power to manipulate men, and she used it. So after dating Matt for a year and 8 months, they broke up. And she continued sleeping with him until she met a 42-year-old divorced father named Daryl Brewer. So Jody is 22 at this point, and Daryl is a food and beverage manager, and he makes great money. Daryl had previously hired Jody at a restaurant, but then he decided to quit his job to spend more time with his children. And he told Jody, quote, "Look, I'm bitter about my divorce, and I don't ever want to get married again. I didn't see myself having a girlfriend, but I like you if you're okay with that," end quote. Now here's where Jody's clinging to a man who openly tells her he doesn't want anything to do with her becomes the problem. She thinks that she can change his mind, even though Daryl flat up says, "I still love my ex-wife. I don't want to marry you." Jody wants to get married. She wants an official relationship, and she will do this same pattern again with Travis. So remember these patterns. Now, Jody begins changing herself to replicate Daryl's ex-wife. She bleaches her hair blonde, just like the ex. She gets breast implants of the exact same cup size as the ex, and even buys the same model of vehicle as the ex-wife. Abort mission, abort mission, DEFCON 1. This is so bad. This is so embarrassing. Like, am I the only one here who has secondhand embarrassment? Does Jody not realize how thirsty this comes off? I just used the word thirsty. I just lost all professionalism. The replication and obsessive behavior reveal the lack of confidence that Jody has for herself, and it's dangerous and not sexy, chica. Like, emulation to this degree is not healthy. Be yourself and evolve who you are and what makes you a better person. Don't become someone else for someone else. I'm sorry, that was very preachy, but if it makes anybody feel better, I feel better now. Be yourself. Testify. Anyways, Daryl is always talking about his ex-wife, and he decided to move closer to her because he missed her. Jody would move in with him, and life at this point for them is actually pretty good. It's pretty dandy. So in 2005, Daryl and Jody buy a house together in Palm Desert after 3 years of dating. Jody didn't have enough money to put down for the house, so Daryl covered it. And it didn't take long for their home to go into foreclosure, and Jody would start to lose interest in Daryl. So at this time, she's making side cash by selling insurance for prepaid legal. And this is basically where you pay into a company that allows you access to good lawyers if you need them. So Jody decides to go to a prepaid legal convention in Las Vegas because she is selling insurance. And this is where Jody Arias meets 29-year-old motivational speaker and entrepreneur Travis Alexander. Travis Victor Alexander was born on July 28, 1977 in Riverside, California, to Gary and Pamela Alexander. He was one of 8 children. Travis's childhood was unconventional, to say the least. His parents were drug addicts, and their house was described as filthy. His life was difficult, and nutritional food was rarely provided to the children. They relied on rotten scraps and instant noodles. At the age of 11, Travis's abusive father died and left his children to be raised by their gentle religious grandmother. Adamant about not becoming like his parents, Travis turned to the Mormon religion. At 18 years old, Travis traveled to Colorado to participate in the Mormon mission to spread the gospel and expand the church's membership. In his early 20s, Travis worked hard to faithfully follow the Mormon rules, one being abstaining from sexual intercourse outside of marriage. This would be his ultimate weakness. Travis began engaging secretly in sex with other Mormon women. When the church found out, he was banned from practicing Mormonism for a year, not even allowed to enter the temple. When he regained his temple privileges, he began having sex with non-Mormon women. At this time, Travis was struggling financially and decided to join prepaid legal. Travis became very successful at his young age. He was now making great money and was able to purchase a 4,000 square foot home in Mesa, Arizona. The house had 5 bedrooms and 3 baths. Travis decided it was an excellent idea to rent out 2 of the bedrooms to roommates to help pay the mortgage. In September 2006, Travis attended the prepaid legal convention in Las Vegas, Nevada. He had been hanging out with other representatives at a restaurant when he locked eyes with the beautiful Jody Arias. Instantly, Jody became enamored watching Travis carry on enthusiastic conversations with his friends. His jovial laugh and his wide smile intrigued the young woman. Eventually, Travis decided to introduce himself, and their connection was immediate. The next day, Travis invited Jody to a convention's executive exclusive party. Jody felt excited, but this joy soon faded when she realized that she didn't have a dress for the event. To her surprise, Travis had offered to buy her an evening dress, and she felt like Cinderella off to the ball. That night, Travis and Jody discussed their previous relationships, and she informed him about her current lover, Daryl, and how things were fizzling out. Not a week later, Jody broke it off with Daryl, and with the intent to pursue Travis. The couple's relationship was solely based on sex in the beginning. Travis began telling Jody about Mormonism and how their relationship must be kept a secret. He was not allowed to have a relationship with a woman who did not share the same faith. Jody had already mentally attached herself to Travis within the first few weeks of sleeping together. When she told him she wanted to learn more about the church and convert, Travis was pleased. But he wasn't enthusiastic about the concept of marrying her so soon, especially if she just wanted to be public. Yet Travis enjoyed the sex he was having with Jody. It was different than his other encounters. It was raw and rough. This excited Travis, as no other woman was willing to give it to him, and he didn't want to lose that. Once the convention was over, Jody traveled back to California, where she carried on a long-distance relationship with Travis. Whenever they planned to meet up, it would be halfway. The couple would stay at a home belonging to Chris and Sky Hughes, close friends of Travis. They had to keep their sexual encounters a secret. So at night, they would sneak into each other's rooms to have oral sex. On November 26, 2006, Travis, being Jody's spiritual advisor, had baptized her into the Mormon religion. She took the same religious vows of no sex outside of marriage as Travis. And as soon as the ceremony was over, the two snuck off to engage in anal sex. Jody would later tell the courts that she felt uncomfortable with Travis's contradicting behavior concerning the church's teachings. Yet, it didn't seem to bother her when she wasn't baptized. She claimed that Travis told her that anal sex was considered okay because it did not involve vaginal penetration. Either way, Jody continued to have a secret, passionate sexual relationship with Travis. They would meet in hotels and parking lots to get off. And when they were not together, most of their days were spent talking on the phone and having phone sex. As time passed, Jody felt Travis starting to lose interest in her emotionally. It seemed that whenever he called her, it was only to have sex. He had told her that he did not want to be seen together in public in any way, and that he did not want an official relationship. Jody thought that because she was now a Mormon, Travis would want her and want to marry her, but this was not the case. Jody confessed to feeling like a sex worker at the time, and that Travis took advantage of her loving him, but she still continued to fight for his love. According to those who knew Travis, he thought that their sexual relationship was mutual, because he had told her specifically what he wanted, and she never left. He made it clear that he did not want to marry her. But by now, Jody and Travis were progressing into full vaginal intercourse against their vows. Jody could have felt that this was her way of winning her man over, especially if he was now doing what he refused to do before. In December of that year, Travis hosted a mixer for the members of the prepaid legal group. He specifically excluded Jody from the gathering. He had zero intention of introducing her to his friends and co-workers. When Jody found out, she drove to his house and started introducing herself as Travis's girlfriend. Quickly, Travis began the damage control, convincing his friends that the two were only friends and nothing else. The public rejection caused Jody to see red. She began stalking Travis everywhere he went, from the store to even waiting outside of his bathroom. Travis's friends testified that she was all over him like a lovesick eighth grader. At every opportunity, she would pounce on his neck. If he were sitting, she would straddle him, interrupting the conversation. Travis would politely push her aside and tell her to stop, but she would never listen. Clancy Talbot, a friend of Travis's, detailed the possessiveness of Jody, saying, quote, "She just had to sit right by him. She didn't appreciate when he was talking to another female. She didn't like the fact that there was anyone that didn't know they were together. She wanted it clear that they were." Jody then created a graphic t-shirt that said, "Travis Alexander's" in bold print across the chest. She would tell people that he made it for her. As his friends grew increasingly more concerned about Jody, they started warning him about her. One event occurred when Chris and Sky Hughes were in a hot tub with Travis just relaxing, when Jody splashed her way in. She clung to Travis like a leech in a lake, while giggling profusely. Travis was clearly embarrassed and tried to push Jody away. Finally, when Travis was alone, the two friends voiced their concern. Sitting in his house with the door closed, Sky recalled feeling like they were being spied on. She and her husband had just warned Travis about Jody's insane territorial behavior. Travis awkwardly brushed it off, defending Jody, saying that she was a nice person. The three fell silent when Sky pointed to the closed door and whispered, "I think she's outside listening to us." Travis just laughed. Later, he got up, and when he opened the door, he found Jody standing inches away from his face, eyes wide with fury. After hearing the conversation, Jody became paranoid. She began secretly going through Travis's cell phone when he was sleeping or showering. She was checking his emails, his social media accounts, and then would forward all the conversations to herself. The two continued having a sexual relationship, and she desperately attempted to convince Travis to be official. When he would refuse, Jody would start going on dates with other men from the Mormon church, but only to make Travis jealous. Unfortunately for Jody, Travis could care less. 5 months had passed, and Travis had decided that he was going to finally break things off with Jody. Enraged by the boundaries placed out by Travis, she began forging letters from a fake stalker that said he was following her and was madly in love with her. The letters went on to say that Travis didn't deserve her and that he couldn't protect her because he lived far away. The progression of her obsessive behavior was only getting worse. She continued to beg Travis to get back together, and she started making unannounced trips, 5 hours from California to Arizona, to sneak into his house at night. She would peek in through windows to see if he was sleeping with other women, and would proceed to crawl in through the doggy door late at night. One night, Jody snuck into his bedroom and took his cell phone. She fished through his accounts and discovered sexual messages and emails sent to a married woman from his church. In 2007, Jody decided to move to Mesa, Arizona, so she could live closer to Travis. He was baffled by the idea that she was there. Travis was dating other women, and now that Jody was arriving more unannounced at his house, it became a problem. Sometimes Travis would be angry when she appeared at his front door, acting all sweet and innocent, and other times, he would take advantage of the fact that she was there and proceed to have sex with her. In early July, Travis had started seeing an 18-year-old woman named Lisa Andrews at their church functions. The 29-year-old Travis Alexander had made that relationship public. But it was on and off again, due to Lisa thinking that he was cheating on her with Jody, because she was always around. Lisa explained that Travis denied the accusations and suggested that her and Travis should get married. Travis was so persistent about marrying Lisa that it pushed her away and they broke up. What a mess, eh? It's like, I personally don't understand how Jody thinks this is okay. Like, it's not cute, it's not romantic, it's creepy. And this is where it gets interesting. On September 23rd, 2007, Lisa Andrews wrote Travis an email explaining that she and him were done. And in this email, Lisa wrote that Travis was hypersexual and wanted kinkier sex than she was comfortable giving him without breaking her Mormon vows outside of marriage. So Travis rallied this, saying that his love language was physical contact, which is why he enjoyed touching her a lot in public and at home. But he respected that she didn't want any of it anymore. And that's something that he didn't do with Jody. He didn't want anybody knowing that they were sleeping together. He wanted no one to see. He didn't touch her in public. He was like, meter stick, here we go. And she was, I'll be blunt, his dirty little sex doll, which Jody said that Travis called her his, quote, three-holed wonder. Woof. So later in court, Lisa would testify that she wrote that email out of anger and said that she and Travis would resolve their differences and they got back together. It's obvious to see that Travis was a sexual person, and due to his own choices, he joined the Mormon church, and this put a very large barrier around something that he could not resist, sex. He allowed himself to have casual sex with Jody. He flat up told her, I will not marry a woman who is not Mormon. And she said, well, I'll be a Mormon. I'm interested if that'll make you like me. And he's like, okay, but I'm not going to marry you. And she's like, that's okay. Challenge accepted. Ha ha. He baptizes her, and immediately she starts pushing more and more to be in an official relationship. And Travis starts pushing back, saying, no, I just want sex with you. But Jody thinks that she can change his mind. And that's where the problem lies. Because this casual sex, Travis couldn't see these red... You know what? No, he did see these red flags, but he just wanted to get boinked so bad that he didn't particularly care. And I want to draw attention to the elephant in the room. First and foremost, Jodi had no right to do what she does at the end of this case. Spoiler alert, she resorts to murder. Did Travis use her for sex? Yes. Did he make that clear? Yes. Was it wrong of Travis to use her for sex when she was clearly madly in love with him? Yes. But that does not give Jodi a right to kill him. Plain and simple. He made his need for casual sex known and told Jodi that that's all they were. When she got creepier, he would break up with her. But that primal urge made Travis go back, and this is ultimately his kryptonite. Jodi knew that sex was his weakness, and she used it to keep baiting him back. Then she'd want a relationship, he'd say no, push her away, and the cycle continues. Now, many people tried to warn Travis, but he clearly didn't read true crime, am I right? My ass would have Kevin McAllistered the hell out of my house if that shit was going on, as soon as Jodi started crawling through doggy doors. Like, we all know I have absolutely zero tolerance for stalking. I post awareness about it on the Instagram page all the time. I've dealt with it. I've dealt with enough fruitcakes in my life. I'm good. I want to be in my zone. You do you, boo-boo, but not with me. Okay, we good? I'm good. No stalking. Get bent. Fuck off. It's not sexy. Now, Jodi thinks it's sexy. So now we're at this point where Travis has had enough, because now she's hacking into his accounts and sending messages to women from his accounts. And he's scared to go file a police report with the issue, because if the church finds out, he's going to get kicked out again for doing the hibbity-dibbity outside of marriage. It's near the end of 2007, and Travis is telling Jodi that enough is enough, and she needs to go away because he's officially dating Lisa Andrews. And Jodi becomes that piece of tape stuck to the end of the finger that you cannot for the life of you get off. Travis and Lisa had a happy relationship. They were not having sex, and they were spending their quality time learning about each other mentally. Lisa would testify that she was shocked to discover that at the trial, Travis was not a virgin, because he was so devoted to the church. Meanwhile, Jodi was stalking Lisa and Travis daily. While Lisa was spending time at Travis's home, Jodi would frequently bang on the windows and doors to try to scare them. She would stand outside of the windows and stare at them until Travis would yell at her to leave. Jodi slashed their tires on multiple occasions, and all of this was too much for Lisa, and she broke up with Travis again. The following year in April, Jodi returned to her family in California. Travis was beyond ecstatic with the news. He told his friend Sky Hughes, quote, "I'm excited. I'm getting my life back. Like, this is a whole new start. She's gone." Unbeknownst to Travis's friends, Jodi had messaged him, and he had begun sexting her again since he was single. The two would get into arguments during phone sex, but they always made up. They started taking road trips to locations from a book titled A Thousand Places to Visit Before You Die. After their extended road trip, Travis wanted Lisa back, tossing Jodi to the curb. An anonymous letter was emailed to Lisa from a Jane Doe account, acting as a concerned Mormon who accused Lisa of engaging in premarital sex with Travis, attempting to convince her to repent for her sins and follow the Mormon rules and end the relationship with Travis. When accused, Jodi denied writing the anonymous letter. Here are the contents of what the anonymous letter said. "You are a shameful whore. Your heavenly father must be deeply ashamed of the whoredom you've committed with that insidious man. If you let him stay in your bed one more time or even sleep under the same roof as him, he will be giving the appearance of evil. You are driving away the Holy Ghost, and you are wasting your time." Even though Jodi was living in Eureka, California with her grandparents, she was still hacking Travis's email and Facebook accounts. If she seen that Travis had added a new friend or liked another woman's photo, Jodi would leap into action and follow that person. She worked very hard trying to worm her way into his life. Jodi continued to drive to Travis's home when he was not around. She would rearrange his furniture in hopes to spook him of her never-ending lingering. When Travis discovered this, he sent her a frustrated text that read, quote, "I don't want your apology. I want you to understand what I think of you. I want you to understand how evil I think you are. The worst thing that has ever happened to me." While all of this was going on, Travis was currently planning a prepaid legal trip to Cancun, Mexico for June 10th, 2008 with his friends from the company. Warning, the following contains graphic descriptions of murder and is not suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised. On May 18th, 2008, Travis wrote a blog describing his perfect wife. None of the attributes he expressed described Jodi. When Jodi read the descriptions, she started getting more enraged that Travis was publicly expressing that he was upset that he wasn't married by 30 years old, and she was nowhere in his plans. On May 28th, Jody staged a burglary at her grandparents' house, where only a DVD player, $30 of Jody's own money, and a .25 caliber handgun were reported stolen. Next, Jody contacted a man she had been dating since April 2008, Ryan Burns. Ryan was a coworker at Prepaid Legal. She spontaneously decided to meet him in Utah. Jody stated to Ryan that she was going to buy jerry cans for the long trip, so she didn't have to stop along the way, and gas would be cheaper. On June 2nd, Jody rented a Ford Focus in Redding, California. She then texted Travis, letting him know that she would be in town and she wanted to stop and see him. Travis said that he didn't want to see her. On June 4th, Jody traveled to Travis's house, where they proceeded to have sex and take provocative naked photos together. They ranged from Jody being naked resting on her elbows to a close-up of her genitalia and anus, which would be used against her later in court. But what was next left the investigators haunted. Photos of Travis taken in a small shower. The last photo, where Travis was still alive, shows him sitting in a cramped shower, looking up at the camera with a sad expression. Then not 2 minutes later, Jody Arias murdered Travis Alexander, taking the gun and knife with her. After the murder, Jody traveled to Las Vegas, and then to Utah, where she met up with a friend to have dinner. Her primary purpose was to establish a solid alibi. Ryan Burns would later testify in court that Jody was several hours late and she arrived at his home on June 5th, 2008. Jody insisted that she had gotten lost and had to stop to rest. She had bandaged cuts on her hands, and she explained to Ryan that she got the injuries from glass at work. Later that same evening, the couple attended a meeting for a Prepaid Legal Service convention and then went to a restaurant with business associates. When Jody and Ryan got back to his place, they slowly began making out. Ryan testified, quote, "She got on top of me aggressively, and we were kissing. She was right on top of me." Prosecution would question the strength of Jody, wondering if she could take down Travis. The answer was yes. Ryan Burns said, quote, "She's a lot stronger than she looks." Leaving Utah, Jody traveled back to Eureka, California, where she told her family that she was going on a road trip because she was worried that she would be blamed for something. Her parents, who she rarely contacted, were left confused by Jody's cryptic message. Jody was strategically leaving voice messages and text messages to Travis's phone, wondering where he was, and she hoped that he would have a great time in Cancun. Jody goes as far as to tell him that she might sleep at his house when he's gone, if she started to miss him while on his trip. Jody returned the rental car to the budget rental agency. The owner testified that once the car was returned, the floor mats were missing and Kool-Aid-like stains were in the back seat. The evidence would not get a chance to be collected by forensics. On June 9th, 2008, the naked body of 30-year-old Travis Alexander was found mutilated in the shower by his friends. Detective Esteban Flores responded to the 911 call. When the officers arrived at Travis's 4,000-square-foot home in Mesa, Arizona, upon entering the house, the foul odor of decomposition hit them immediately. Large quantities of blood were found in the master bedroom that led into an ensuite bathroom. The sink and mirror were splattered with blood, and scrunched on the shower floor was the decomposing body of Travis Alexander. With the bullet lodged inside of his cheek, there was a total of 27 stab wounds to his neck, head, heart, torso, and limbs. His throat had been slit from ear to ear so deep that the cervical spine had been reached. His hands showed signs of defensive wounds. The webbing between his fingers was sliced, and he had cuts on his face. Detectives concluded that with such intricacies to inflict pain on a person to this degree pointed to a crime of passion, and suicide was ruled out. What shocked officers was how all the friends and family members were adamant that they investigate a young woman named Jody Arias. Forensics began collecting evidence from Travis's home. What was retrieved included a .25 caliber bullet casing, a ball of long hairs crushed in blood, as well as a palm print smeared in blood that was on the wall. The most critical piece of evidence that was found was in the adjoining laundry room. When investigators opened the washing machine, they retrieved a digital camera. Whoever dumped the camera with a blood-soaked towel in the wash with bleach had run a cycle in hopes of destroying the evidence. What the person did not consider was removing the waterproof memory card. 2 days after the body of Travis Alexander was discovered, Detective Flores received a phone call informing him that Jody Arias was reaching out to speak with him. It's rare for perpetrators to personally contact investigators. They believed that it was because she was innocent. But Jody's willingness to offer information was her way of fishing for information. In the conversation with Detective Flores, Jody explained that she had not seen Travis in over a month because they had broken up. At the time of his murder, she had been on a road trip to Las Vegas and to Utah to meet a friend. Detective Flores decided to meet with Jody for an interview regarding her whereabouts. Jody had told him that she would be in Mesa, Arizona on June 19th for Travis's memorial service. When the officers arrived at the funeral, they noticed the odd behavior of Jody that was making Travis's family and friends uncomfortable. She was acting as a grieving widow, introducing herself to everyone saying, "We are so happy you came, and my Travis would be very happy." After the service, Jody went to the police station where her fingerprints and DNA were collected. When Detective Flores asked for a formal interview, Jody started backing out. She responded that she wasn't able to because she had an engagement and must head home to California promptly. Over the following days, Jody continued to call Detective Flores regarding the movement of the investigation. Jody had a particular interest in the suspects and if any evidence was found. Of course, Detective Flores remained closed for specifics. The forensics had matched Jody's DNA with the hair at the scene and the prints left on the wall in blood. This put Jody in the bathroom at the time of the death. But what made the evidence more concrete were the time-stamped photos recovered from the digital camera left in the washing machine. With the evidence proving that Jody was the only one at the scene of the crime the night Travis was murdered, the police had what they needed to arrest Jody. And on July 9, 2008, Jody Arias was arrested on her 28th birthday. She asked the officers if she could clean herself up and put makeup on before she took her mugshot. She was denied that request. For her first phone call, she didn't call a lawyer. She called her parents and asked them to Google her name. During the interrogation, Jody acted quite strange for a person who was arrested for murder. Occasionally, she would sob with no tears. But for the most part of the interview, Jody acted childlike and tried to be cute whenever she described her whereabouts as if nothing had happened. When asked if she killed Travis Alexander, she responded that she was nowhere near Mesa, Arizona, and that she was on a road trip. Jody raised red flags with investigators when she used overemphasized words like absolutely, honestly, and never repeatedly when proclaiming her innocence by trying to sell the detectives a story. Body language expert Chris Ulrich explained that Jody uses these words when she's trying to convince someone of the truth, when an honest person will simply convey the truth. Detective Flores began revealing the photographs of her and Travis the day of the murder, pointing out how the last picture of Travis was taken at 5:29 p.m., and that the time Travis died was deemed 5:32 p.m. There were photos taken after the shot of Travis, but it looked as though the camera had been dropped and continuously started going off. Jody again insisted that she didn't know what happened, and when Jody was shown the pictures of her naked on the bed, she only commented on how the girl really did look like her, and that if Travis were there, he would testify that the woman in the photos was clearly not Jody. Detective Flores, he used these interrogation tactics that got Jody to admit that she killed Travis, but she never actually admitted to guilt. So in an interrogation video, Jody says, "It's obvious that I was there," and Detective Flores responds by saying, "No, it's obvious that you did this." Jody continues to say, quote, "I did not plan to hurt him in any way. I would never stab him. I would shoot him. I don't think I could stab him. I think I would have to shoot him until he was dead if that were my intentions. But I would have to wear gloves. If I had it in me to kill him, at least, I could have done this by making it as humane as possible," end quote. There's that narcissistic behavior peeking through. I can only imagine her rationalizing to those listening, "Although I didn't kill him, if I were to kill him, I would have been nice about it. Bitch, no." So whenever she finally confesses to anything she's responsible for, which is basically pulling teeth to get there, she immediately goes into narcissistic damage control, where, "Yes, I did it, but it's only because, insert whoever, made me do it. Remember that I am the real victim here." So backtrack to her growing marijuana on the roof of the family home. This is a good example. She says, "It was mine, but I wouldn't have had to grow it if my friend Patty hadn't introduced me to pot." So she genuinely cannot fathom herself publicly being the bad guy. So she must be the victim. And I was going to wait to say this, but I'm actually going to say it now because it truly solidifies the point I'm trying to make. After Jody was found guilty of first degree murder, spoiler alert, the jury had to decide whether or not to give her the death penalty. And while Jody takes the stand to save her own ass from the death sentence, she pleads to the jury to only give her life in prison and not the execution because although she did murder Travis Alexander, she doesn't want her own family to be hurt by her death. And then in front of Travis's family and friends, Jody proceeds to lift up a shirt that she had made that said survivor, calling herself a survivor of abuse after she has already been charged and convicted of first-degree murder. And that is such a power move on her end. And the two things that come to my mind while I was watching the closing statements during her trial and she lifts up that shirt, number one, the audacity of this woman, and two, so much for claiming that it was Travis who made the, quote, Travis Alexander belongs to me t-shirts a month prior. Oh yes, Jody, we haven't forgotten that you said that either. Many forensic psychologists and psychiatrists all believe that Jody is lying about the domestic violence that she claims she suffered from Travis. Dr. Janine DeMarte, a psychologist for the prosecution, testified that Jody was not a victim of domestic abuse and was most likely diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, which is characterized by fears of abandonment and angry outbursts. Jody wrote in a diary for years, and during that time she dated Travis, she never mentioned any sort of domestic abuse from Travis. Forensic psychologist Dr. Stephen Reich provided an analysis of Jody, and he described Jody as a woman who is very much aware of her power of sexuality, and Jody is a narcissist and needs to be in control of every situation that she is in. And the more she opens her mouth to talk, the more she dooms herself. Experts call Jody Arias a pathological liar and manipulator, and each lie violated common sense, which is how doctors were able to read her like a first grade comic book. Forensic psychologist Cheryl LaRoute and Judy Ho pointed out that not only was Jody lying about the abuse from her parents, but also the abuse from Travis. Together, they explain that Jody's lying record of pattern abuse can be distorted through her own memories. The more she says that she was abused by men, the more people, specifically females, will believe her. She claimed abuse from her father and from Travis, and both men had no previous history of physical abuse towards women. And true survivors of domestic abuse have been extremely offended by Jody Arias, and they continue to voice their opinions against her for lying. All right, so here's where we are. I kind of jumped forward a little bit talking about the trial and her diagnosis, but that was to prove my point of what we were discussing. Time travel back a little bit. This is where we are. Jody has been arrested, and the detective, Detective Flores, is laying out all this evidence against her story, and she continues to say that she wasn't near Mesa, Arizona when any of this happened. And the detective's sitting there like, Jody, come on. But Jody believes that she's smarter than the detective. And he realizes that she's not going to confess anytime soon, so he stops the interrogation. And Jody starts acting very strange when no one's in the room. She begins singing in a creepy, slow range tone. She starts lecturing herself for not putting on makeup that day. And she rummages through the garbage can. And then she starts doing handstands against the wall. And she starts sitting on the floor. So what this seems like is Jody's trying really hard to act overly not bothered by the situation she's in. It's kind of like a coping mechanism. So 3 weeks go by and Jody realizes that she needs to change her story because her story's not going to hold up in court. She has all this evidence against her and she contacts Detective Flores and schedules another interrogation. By now, she's had enough time to think of a new story. She says that she didn't kill Travis, but she was there the night he was murdered. Here's the story. Her and Travis were getting spicy in the bathroom when two intruders, a man and a woman, busted in wearing ski masks so she would not be able to identify them in a police lineup if she had to. They render Jody unconscious and she falls to the floor. And this right here, Fear Cult, is why I start these cases with graphic detail from the beginning. Because it's these small little details that give progression patterns of the criminal later on. So Jody said that as a teenager, her dad rendered her unconscious by throwing her against a doorframe unprovoked. Then her first boyfriend, Bobby Juarez, started choking her unprovoked and almost rendered her unconscious. And then she'll say again, later in the story, she'll accuse Travis of choking her and trying to render her unconscious because she dropped his new camera. And according to her, that's why she had to kill him. It was out of self-defense. It's insanity to me, this woman. So Travis has zero history in anger or aggression problems. But Jody sticks to that story that it was two intruders. And Detective Flores goes, okay, Jody, is that your story? Is that what you're sticking with this time? She goes, yep, that's what happened. And he goes, I'll see you in court. And then Jody is charged with the murder of Travis Alexander. While waiting 3 years for her trial to start, Jodi decided to go on a whirlwind media frenzy to preach her innocence. With her hair done and adding the few final touches to her makeup, she would go on camera to tell her version of the murder, where masked intruders held her hostage and then let her go, threatening to murder her and her family if she ever went to the police. Evidence was not given to the media to protect the case, and all the world heard was Jodi's sugar-coated words for years, gaining her a large following from supporters. Jodi told the world, quote, "No jury will convict me, because I am innocent, and you can mark my words on that. No jury will ever convict me." And on January 2nd, 2013, the world watched as Jodi Ann Arias arrived for her first day in court. She was wearing all black and glasses. Gone was her bleach blonde hair, and she was now wearing it in natural brown. Board-certified physician and clinical professor of psychiatry, Dr. Drew Pinsky, discussed the bizarre similarities between Jodi and her court-appointed attorney, Jennifer Wilmot. Jodi would do her hair the same, wear similar glasses, and even dress alike. It's pointed out how Jodi would even mirror the hand gestures of her defense attorney to give the subliminal message that she must be innocent. Jodi's team hired a jury consultant to instruct Jodi how to dress and act in court. She stopped posing for cameras and fixing her appearance like she did in the pre-trial interviews. Now, she was just the simple Jodi Arias. The case evidence against Jodi was solid. The defense team informed Jodi that their strategy was to protect her from getting the death penalty in Arizona. The best strategy was to get Jodi to be completely honest with the courts. But Jodi changed her story three times. She was no longer a hostage survivor. She was now a domestic abuse survivor. In court, Jodi pleaded self-defense in the murder of Travis Alexander. And on the stand, Jodi explained that Travis was truly the obsessive one, and he could not let her go. That the final fight was over her dropping his brand new camera, and he went ballistic. So Jodi testified that she created the intruder scenario because she loved Travis oh so much, and she didn't want to ruin his reputation. Then, right after, she starts painting this very damaging picture of the so-called man that she loved. Jodi gave the defense team letters that were allegedly written by Travis to her, admitting that he was a pedophile and wanted her to wear children's underwear during sex. So Kirk Nurmi was like, "Jodi, oh my god, you need to cut the shit. You're guilty. It's obvious. My job now is to make sure that you don't get the death penalty because I'm stuck being your lawyer." And thank God the defense team didn't believe her. But Jodi takes these letters and she tries to just throw them around the media in hopes that the media would believe it and print all these articles on Travis being a pedophile. And even the media didn't believe her. So everyone's telling Jodi to cut the shit and she goes to court. So it was later revealed that Jodi was discovered in her jail cell with samples of Travis's actual handwriting that she had been trying to replicate for months before the trial. And then finally, once her lawyer said, "Yeah, you need to ixnay on that. We're not even going there. It's a lie. You know it's a lie. Stop it." So now the trial's going, and out of the blue, Jodi just blurts out this claim that she walked in on Travis masturbating to child pornography, and you can just feel the lawyers go, "Again, stop, Jodi. Just stop lying." And they pointed out that none of her journal entries never mentioned anything about this groundbreaking discovery on her part, and they basically said, "Stop lying." The defense team, they try to portray Jodi as an innocent victim of sexual and physical domestic assault, who was easily manipulated into engaging in sex with Travis. Jodi tried to prove this by saying that Travis broke her finger, and she proceeds to hold up her hand in court with her finger bent, and it just looks like she's double jointed. And then she's like, I haven't been able to straighten it out since. It's awful." And then the prosecutors, I love this. The prosecutors pull up a photo of her where her hand is clearly fine. Her finger is fine. And it was taken days after the alleged incident. So it would have been at its all-time worst when that photo was taken, if it was true. So one piece of evidence that was used in court was a phone call recorded by Jodi with Travis having no consent of it and they're having phone sex. Guys, this recording is 1 hour and 8 minutes long, and it was debated whether or not the court should hear it due to the very vivid picture these two paint and what they would like to do to each other. So I listened to it. In summation, this graphic phone call was basically them having BDSM phone sex. And it can be heard in the call that Jody is loving it. She's not hesitant or holding back even a little. She's not being forced to do this phone call. The only thing that is missing is the Pornhub intro. I swear to God. And the defense team, for God knows what reason, thinks that this is good enough evidence to prove that Travis was sadistic and wanted to hurt Jody. But what it ended up proving was that Jody was just as kinky as Travis, and she was not forced in any way to engage in this phone call. And during the trial, while this recording is being played, Jody looks like she is so proud of herself and needs an adult film award for her phone sex capabilities. Meanwhile, no one, not a single goddamn person in this court, is enjoying this phone call. So the prosecution, they waste no time debunking all of Jody's claims, with years worth of evidence pointing that Travis was being stalked and harassed by Jody. They went on to explain that sex was a manipulation tactic utilized by Jody to get Travis back whenever he wanted to leave her. His murder was the final straw for Jody, and this was the last attempt to try to get him back. So the two engaged in sex, and he still didn't want to get back with her, let alone marry her, and Jody was enraged, and she killed him out of a premeditated crime of passion. Then the photographs from the digital camera were shown to the court, and these darn photos, oh my goodness. Jody claimed that they initially weren't even of her, and it was a woman that looked like her that Travis must have been sleeping with. Then she claimed that the police photoshopped her face on the pictures, and then the defense team would use the argument that Jody was forced into taking these photos by Travis and forced her to have anal sex. Jody Arias then gets diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, and then on May 2nd, 2013, the closing arguments begin. Prosecutors describe Arias as being a manipulative liar who meticulously planned the savage attack. The next day, defense attorney Kirk Nurmi implored jurors to take an impartial view on the case with his client, even if they don't like her. He even stated that he himself doesn't even like Jody Arias. I think that says a lot about the case. And through random fake tears and lies, the trial of Jody Arias concluded on May 8, 2013 at 1:49 p.m. 34-year-old Jody Ann Arias was found guilty of first-degree murder of Travis Alexander. The sentencing phase of the trial began on May 9th. The jury had to decide whether Jody Arias was going to face the death sentence or serve life in prison without parole. Initially, Jody wanted the death penalty. She believed that death would bring her untold peace and freedom. When Jody addressed the jury during her penalty phase, she asked for them to spare her life, saying, quote, "I cannot in good conscience ask you to sentence me to death because of them." Arias then pointed to her family. "Either way, I will spend the rest of my life in prison. It will either be shortened or not. If it is shortened, the people who will be hurt is my family. I'm asking, please, please don't do that to them." Jody then held up a white t-shirt with one word printed across the front, "Survivor," telling the jurors that she is a domestic abuse victim at the hands of Travis Alexander. The family and friends of Travis could not believe what they were witnessing. Jody went on to explain that she planned to sell the clothing and donate the proceeds to the victims of domestic abuse. The jury vote was deadlocked, and after two mistrials, the death penalty was removed. The judge then sentenced Jody Arias to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Currently, Jody Arias is 42 years old and serving her life sentence in Perryville Prison in Arizona. While in prison, Jody began dating an art dealer who allowed her to sell her paintings from prison. Jody even filed three post-trial claims against her defense attorney, Kirk Nurmi, two dealing with a breach of attorney-client privilege. The court ruled in Nurmi's favor, and the two were dismissed. The third claim is against the tell-all book Nurmi wrote titled Trapped with Miss Arias, where he explains specific client details that Jody did not consent to. The book knowingly violated his duty to protect confidential information between Jody and himself. The self-published tell-all was considered an attempt to redeem his public image from the involuntary servitude to Jody Arias during the trial. Jody then began slandering Nurmi, claiming that he had a sexual fascination with her in the case. Even from prison, Jody continues to recreate the dysfunction of her previous relationships for power. Kirk Nurmi is now disbarred for ethical violations concerning his misconduct, From prison, Jody continues to gain followers, who still believe she is innocent. After the 2013 trial, Jody was swept off to a previously scheduled interview with ABC News. When the interviewer asked Jody why she continues to talk when nobody believes what's coming out of her mouth, Jody stated that although she has lied, she is not a liar by definition, and she felt betrayed by the jury. When asked, "Why don't you accept the fate of the death penalty if you know that's closure for Travis's family? It's what they want. If you truly care about their closure, why don't you give them that?" Jody calmly responded by saying, quote, "I've caused them a lot of pain. I've caused my family a lot of pain, and I think that by asking for more death, I'm only going to cause more pain to my family." Digging more into the psyche of Jody, the interviewer asked her, if that were her on the jury and heard all of the graphic details, would she have given herself death? Jody said, quote, "I don't believe in capital punishment." So the answer would be no. That is the true story of Jody Arias and her sick obsession with poor Travis Alexander. If someone is stalking you and making you uncomfortable, whether it's in person or online, it is criminal harassment and it is illegal. So document everything and speak to the authorities. Figure out your best route. The worst part of it is that the person doing the stalking more often than not is so lonely and obsessed that they don't even consider it stalking because they're just so blinded by infatuation. And that's exactly what Jody did, which is disgusting. Thank you to Megan and Steve, hosts of the Paranormal Podcast For the Booze, for performing the dramatization this week. I had Megan enlisted as Jody back a while ago when I first thought about doing Jody, because her and Steve performed in the Rock Therio episode for the Anthill Kids, and I thought, Megan would be the best Jody Arias, with all due respect.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
And to continue our never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie, I am recommending the 1993 psychological thriller, The Crush. Not to be confused with the remake, we're talking 1993 version with Cary Elwes and Alicia Silverstone. The plot involves when a writer moves to a new town and he starts renting out the guest house of a rich family, and their daughter, played by Alicia Silverstone, becomes infatuated with him. It's a spiraling mess. Now I tried to scare you, now you tried to scare me. Follow Lullaby the Fear Podcast on Instagram at, you guessed it, Lullaby the Fear Podcast. Reach out, tell me what you think about the episode, and don't forget to rate on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to the podcast. 5 stars truly supports the show. So thank you for listening to this week's lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.